Hi there.
Hi, everybody. I'm Don Landis. I'm an alcoholic. Delighted to be here. Terry, thank you for that kind introduction. I don't remember sharing any wisdom with you. Maybe that's because I have a sponsor who doesn't call those things wise that I say to him. And I want to thank the committee for all your hard work. You know, this has been a wonderful event to witness, not just to be a part of, but to watch all the people working and making sure that everything's set up from the hospitality table to the registration and making sure people are having a good time. And when you come to an event like this, it hides the hard work of the committee when it's done right. It's almost like it's so seamless. But I know I've worked on committees for over 28 years. There's a lot of people that have been spiritually inconvenienced and given up their time so we could all have a great party this weekend. I want to thank the committee for all their hard work. And I want to thank my good friend Don for the invitation to come and share with you this weekend, participate in this great event. And thank you, Don, for that. And I want to thank Terry, you know, my new best friend, for picking me up at the airport. And more importantly, for taking me back to the airport tomorrow. And hopefully I've greased you appropriately that you will do that, because I would like to get home at some point. And I have a sobriety date, September 16th, 1991, puts me at the 31-year mark. I'm very grateful for that. As grateful as I am, I want to be clear, I can't take any credit for it. See, I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am living proof that the program works. Good or bad, I'm an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you can take a man who's given up on life. You can take a man who knows he's never going to get sober. Somebody that has surrendered, but it's not the surrender that we ask our new friends to make. It's a surrender of a desperate alcoholic man who has tried one too many times to go into battle with King Alcohol, that has decided he doesn't want to live this way anymore, has summoned up all his human power and put the drink down, only to find himself drunk in a few days. And if you have one more attempt and one more failure and one more attempt and one more failure at sobriety, maybe what will happen to me will happen to you. You'll finally say, who am I kidding? I know I'm never going to get sober. I know I'm never going to stop. And I surrendered to the idea that I would die a drunkard's death. And I did the things that desperate men do when they know they're going to die. They try to reduce the blast zone, if you will. You cut your family out of your life because it's too hard to see the pain in their face because they know you're dying and you're beyond their reach. You start taking jobs that are beneath you because you just know you can't produce anymore and you want to keep the heat off. You stop driving an automobile because, my God, I don't want to take anybody else with me and I know it's coming. And you put all these barriers, if you will, of safety, all these instruments, these mechanical things that we do to preserve and defend our right to drink because we know we're going to do it. And even with those barriers, even trying to make my drinking safer, if you will, I continue to spiral towards the bottom because alcoholism gets it all. It gets it all. It took everything from me you can possibly take from a human being. And the order of removal, this perfect predator, active alcoholism, the order of removal is the same for most of us. The first stuff it takes is it takes the stuff that money can buy, the stuff that the world can see. It takes my career, it takes my house, takes my car, takes my money, right? And then it starts taking the stuff that's really valuable. And that's the stuff that money can't buy. Hope, dreams, a feeling like tomorrow's worth living, joy, anticipation of the future. It's all in the rearview mirror. Who are we kidding? It's never going to work out. And when it took from me everything you can possibly take from a human being, when the kind thing would have been to kill me, my alcoholism doesn't kill me, does it? It's like a cat playing with a mouse. And it seems to turn its attention on my family because it gets everything. And now they're not sleeping at night. And now they have no hope, no faith, no trust, no feeling like the future's going to work out. And my family's done nothing wrong except they loved an alcoholic. And yet, knowing that I took my family on that hellish ride of active alcoholism, I'm like your typical newcomer when I get here singing that familiar newcomer song, "The Only Person I Hurt Was Myself." And you got to be here a little while and work some steps before you realize that those ripples that go out in the sea of alcoholism never really hit the shore. They just keep spreading out and they'll touch anybody that gets in the way. That's my alcoholism, the perfect predator. It'll hurt everybody that gets anywhere near me. So the fact that I'm 31 years sober, living the best life I've ever known, surrounded by the best people I've ever known, the foundation of my world is based on love. It's funny, that word is behind me here. And I think, what's the most outstanding characteristic of my life today? It's love. There's love in my home. There's love in my friendships. There's love in my approach to life. And I came here, there was no love left. I got two dear friends, Beth and Chuck. I've known them for a very long time. They just came to the event because I knew it'd be here, because they love me. Isn't that crazy? And I love them, but I wouldn't travel this far. So you win the Love Olympics, I guess. So I can't take credit for the good life I have because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not to get sober. Isn't that something? I know there's people in this room, the good, sincere people, that actually came here and said, well, that's enough of that. I'm joining AA, and you knew you were going to get sober. Good for you. I had already proven to myself it was never going to happen. I'm not here to get sober, right? I'm here because I'm dying, right? I'm trying to buy some time, get the heat off, figure out my next move, what geographic I'm going to pull. But I know I'm going to drink again because I always drink again. The dumbest thing we ever say to our new friends, and I heard it when I was new in AA, we don't drink no matter what. Gee, do you think I didn't try that while I was out there before I got to you? Because when I don't drink no matter what, it gets ugly quick between my ears. You know what I mean? It gets a little salty up there. Just so I know who I'm talking to, do we have any new friends to AA in their first year of sobriety? Just raise your hand if you're in your first year. Beautiful, 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 beautiful. And I know this has already happened to you, but I want to do it anyway. I want to cordially welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to cordially welcome you to a brand new life. That's what you get here. We don't fix anybody's life. If you're an alcoholic of my type, there's no raw material left to work with. You know what I mean? It's like bringing your car into the mechanic and they go, look, I'm a mechanic, not a miracle worker. Get another car. There's nothing left to work with. It's all shot, you know? But here we get a brand new life. Anybody here in their first 30, 60, 90 days? Any real brave people? Oh, there's a brave man. Brave, brave. Man, I will never be sober so long that I don't remember what it's like to be in my first 30, 60, 90 days. I'll ask, but you don't have to tell me. I already know, you know. How's it going? Oh, great. Happy. Couldn't be better, you know. You know, it gets worse before it gets better, but I promise you it gets better. And God, we scare newcomers, you know. We don't mean to. You scared the hell out of me when I was new. You know, all the teeth and the happiness, and you're expecting a miracle, and I'm thinking, you should be expecting a head wound, you know. Just back off, and you're coming at me, and I'm so interesting to you. I'm at the low point of my existence, and for some reason, I'm interesting to you. And you know, I know what's going on. I've been here a long time. I know we're just trying to give the newcomers some hope. We're trying to make them feel, we're trying to make them feel welcome, man. But I'm a street guy, and I've been out there, you know, in the street for so long, backing away from life, you know. And I hit this place where it's like, I can see the world and the people in it, but I'm not a part of it anymore. I feel like I've become invisible. And I come to AA, and you come at me with all that love. It's almost overwhelming. When you haven't experienced connectiveness and love in years, it hurts. It's uncomfortable. I know pain. Pain's my friend. I'm comfortable with pain when I get here. But love is repellent. And I know, but I'll never be so sober so long I don't remember what it's like to be new. And it's tough. And we know a lot about you, and that's confusing. Because old-timers would say that to me when I'm new. You know, burn my life to the ground. Where in my wardrobe? And I go, I've been right where you're at. And you're like, I don't think so. I don't think so. But I'm telling you, if you're in your first 30, 60, 90 days, I've been right where you are. We know a lot about you. And you're thinking, how could that be possible? You don't even know me. You don't even know my name. You haven't heard my story. Trust me. You're in your first 30, 60, 90, we know a great deal about you. For instance, this hasn't been a good year. Wasn't a good year for us when we got here either, man. Nobody, Nobody gets here on a winning streak, you know what I mean? And my drinking story is unremarkable. It was fascinating to me when I got here. Wasn't yours? Very unique. Nobody had done the things I had done. Nobody had said the things I had said. Nobody had broken the hearts I had broken. And then you go to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and men and women share openly and honestly in a transparent manner, and you have the gift of identification. And I was brand new, sitting in a meeting, thinking about all the horrible things I had done, and a woman with 25 years, a little sweet gray-haired woman, talked about her drinking and talked about how she got mad at her husband, so she stabbed him. And then she drove him to the emergency room. And while he was standing there holding his side, trying not to bleed out, she said, "And if you don't want any more of that, don't tell him how it happened." And he didn't. And I thought to myself, that's gangster. You know, I thought I was a tough guy. And you start to realize your drunkalogue and all those things you did that you were going to take to the grave with you maybe aren't as impressive or maybe aren't as unique, and maybe you're not the only one that did it. You know, the theme in Alcoholics Anonymous, what this gift of identification produces for a guy like me is I come in here terminally unique, and you people, by telling your stories, what you're really saying to me is, me too. And suddenly, my excuse that I'm alone is removed. Suddenly, I'm no longer the lone wolf. Suddenly, I've found my place. And the reason people feel like they're home when they get to Alcoholics Anonymous is I never had a place to talk about this stuff before. And then I got to do it in a room full of people that know how I feel, have done what I've done, gone where I've gone, and I'm no longer alone. This disease of isolation and separation is dissolved almost instantaneously. If you have just a little bit of willingness, just a little bit of open-mindedness, and you come to AA and you put the cotton in your ears and you take it out of your ears and you put it in your mouth and you listen to men and women and you'll hear your story shared. And you look for the similarities and not the differences, and you'll find yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes it'll be a gray-haired woman stabbing somebody in her story and you'll go, "I identify." And sometimes it'll be a man who talks about all the pain and suffering in his life, and he talked about the day he looked in the mirror and he saw his reflection and he said, "I'm so tired of being you." And it'll open you up because you know how that feels. You know what it's like to wake up on those hangover mornings and wonder how it got so wrong. How did I get so far away from the chosen idea? Haunted by the memory of a time where I didn't have to be drunk to take a deep breath. I didn't have to be inebriated to feel anything. What happened to me? What happened to that bright-eyed boy where there was nothing but potential and hopefulness? What happened to him? How does that stuff get stripped away and squeezed away from our very soul through active alcoholism, dying by degrees with witnesses all around us? And I want to be clear about this. I destroyed myself through active alcoholism with no outside intervention. You know what I mean? There was nobody helping with the process. That was me acting on plan A, right? And more importantly than this, I need to remember this. During my descent to hell, I was surrounded by people that loved me and wanted the best things in the world for me. Girlfriends, family members, doctors, employers, people that were laying down across the railroad tracks of alcoholism and taking the full brunt of the collision of that locomotive that had become my life. Not only did I destroy myself, I destroyed myself where people were trying to stop me. But alcoholism gets it all, doesn't it? And my drinking, like I said, is really unimpressive to me at this point. I went through the three stages that most of us go through. You know, drinking no trouble. And I love that stage, don't you? Drinking no trouble. That's where I would have told anybody to listen, I'll never stop doing this. I fell in love with the effect produced by alcohol. Look, I don't know if I was born alcoholic. I don't get into that debate. Some people say they were and all that had to happen is, but I'll tell you this, I was born weird. You know what I mean? Like half a bubble off a plum, you know. I got two sisters, you know, in the same family, and people would come over. My mom would introduce my sisters, and they'd think, lovely girls. And then they'd meet me and go, there's something with the boy in there, you know. I'm just different, you know. And I've got all the stuff that we talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't even taken a drink yet, you know? I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent, I'm selfish, I'm self-centered. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I'm the guy that traps you in a corner and talks about myself incessantly for 15 minutes straight. You're just trapped. And suddenly I realize I'm doing that. I snapped out of it and go, wait a minute. That's entirely enough about me. What do you think of me? And the... this over-concern with myself, this over-involvement with myself, and what that does is it produces a low-level anxiety, which is my normal waking state. I'm always anxious. I'm always a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I got nothing to compare it to until I got drunk for the first time at 17. Not my first drink, but my first time at 17 where I got enough alcohol on board in one setting to get there. And we all know where there is, because alcohol, as much as anything, it transports me. Takes me to the land of I don't care. And that's where I want to live. I want my mail delivered there. I love the sense of ease and comfort that comes almost immediately with taking a couple of drinks. It says that in the doctor's opinion. It doesn't say getting drunk. It says a sense of ease and comfort that comes almost immediately with taking a couple of drinks. What's wrong with a couple of drinks? I'm a grown man. Grown man can have a couple of drinks, can he? My goodness. But I don't know I'm alcoholic. I don't know I'm in that bizarre 10% of the population where I react differently to alcohol. I have an allergic reaction. We call it the phenomenon of craving. You put any alcohol in my system at all bets are off. Maybe I come to drunk on the couch. Maybe I come to in jail in Tijuana. It's anybody's bet. We don't know. I don't know. It's the worst game show in the world. Let's see what happens to Don tonight. We have some nice parting gifts for you, Don. Head sutures and incarceration, you know. And I don't know that. I don't know I'm in that 10%. I just want to get a little sense of ease and comfort with a couple of drinks. I don't know you put it in me and I'm off to the races. One too many, thousands not enough. I can't stop. I can't predict with any accuracy what's going to happen. So I'm drinking in ignorance, which means what? I'm bringing a knife to a gunfight. I'm overmatched from the beginning, but that doesn't matter. Because I can talk endlessly, and all of us can, about what alcohol did to us. Ah, the pain, the suffering, the failure, right? We talk endlessly about, but I better never forget what it did for me, right? Took an awkward, anxious, shy kid, and I'll tell you, it's magic in a bottle. And I've heard everybody, man, 30 years, I've been listening to your stories, and we all talk about getting drunk for the first time, and we sound the same. I mean, where it happened and who we were with, that stuff changes. But it always sounds some variation on this. I got drunk for the first time and I felt 10 feet tall. I felt better looking, more confident, funnier, smarter. And we say it as though it's fantasy or delusion. I'm not sure. Because I'll tell you what, 17 years old, you put a couple of drinks in me, I am funnier. And I am smarter, and I am tougher, and I am more of what I always hoped and dreamed I could be if I could just get out of the way. You see, the first thing that alcohol ever removed in my life before it took the car and the job and the money and the hope and the potential, the first thing it removed in the very beginning, it removed the self-obsession. I got to actually be where I was, doing what I was doing with the people I was doing it with, and I didn't want to be anywhere else. I didn't want to be anyone else, and I didn't want to be with anyone else. I had freedom for the first time in my life, and I fell in love with the effect produced by alcohol. It had the power to almost instantaneously change my view of reality. I went from awkward and I don't like myself and I don't think I like you to we're going to be together forever. Where are we going next? I went from the guy standing in the back, I don't want to draw any attention to myself, I'm standing on the table and I'm the ringleader. This is what we're going to do and we're going tonight, boys. Saddle up, right? A couple of drinks does that for me. What's wrong with that? Doesn't that sound wonderful? Sounds like freedom to me. And then, man, I would have told anyone that'll listen, I'll never stop doing this. Why would I? And the, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, it's free. I'm not picking up any real tab. I'm not showing up in courtrooms trying to explain my latest event of outrageous behavior. I don't have my mom standing in front of me crying, going, "Don't you know you're killing yourself?" I don't have girlfriends hiding in closets because I'm tearing apart the apartment again in another drunken rage, and they're afraid they're going to get caught up in the hurricane. I guess at 23 years old, you could take all of those things and label them yet to be added to my story. Because every bottom has a trap door. And I learned as an alcoholic, and you probably learned too, you never want to say, "Boy, it can't get any worse than this." You find out quickly you are wrong. And then trouble comes into my story. Second phase of drinking. Drinking with trouble. 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 Alcoholics don't get sober behind trouble. It might get our attention, but we don't get sober behind it. Hell, we build an addition onto the house of our life to make room for trouble. Because I'm an alcoholic, man, and my alcoholism will keep pace with consequence by giving me the two best friends a drinking drug ever had, which are justification and rationalization. And what that looks like is I had to be able to go to jail, and upon my release to face my family who loves me the most and wants the best things in the world for me, I had to be able to look them in the eye with a smile on my face and laughingly say, "Well, everybody goes to jail once in a while." No, they don't. No, they don't. Early in sobriety, every now and then I meet somebody not in AA, but in the business world, you're getting to know each other, asking questions. I'd let that question slip. "You ever been to jail?" They'd be mortified. No. Why on God's green earth would you ask me that? "Have you been to jail?" "Oh, no, not me." Doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth writes, "My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Through failure and repetition of the failure of my human resources, I will be beaten to a state where I will now accept the unacceptable." The life of the drunk. It's unacceptable. It's a waste of life. It's embroidered with pain and failure. Yet I'm accepting it on a daily basis because I don't think there's any other way to live. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You don't believe me? Let's play a game. How many people in this room have ever been handcuffed? Show of hands. Just put them up. Holy smokes! It's worse in Georgia than most places, just telling you. You know? I just want to point out a couple of things really quickly, okay? When you ask that question in a room like this, this is what happens. People think this as they turn to the person next to them. "Well, that's a stupid question. Of course I've been handcuffed, you know?" The other thing you might not realize that I want to point out is you don't get that reaction at the Rotary Club. So it looks like our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Trouble enters my story, doesn't get my attention, but if you keep me in trouble long enough, what will happen is it talks about this around page 39 in the big book. I'll get the so-called gift of self-knowledge. Now, self-knowledge isn't delivered by a family member. Self-knowledge isn't delivered by the court system or by an employer or a doctor that's stitching you up and you don't feel the needle. Because, so, you know, people have talked to me about my drinking for years by this time, and I'm 25 years old. And self-knowledge came to me in a dirty motel room at 2:30 in the morning. And there's all this screaming in the room. And then I realized the room's dead quiet, and the screaming's in my head, in my voice. And the voice keeps saying, "If you keep doing this, you're going to die." And I got it. And I got to be honest with you, it felt like some kind of an answer. It felt like, wow, they've been talking to me for years about my drinking, and now I agree with them. And I got to stop. I wasn't raised this way. This isn't fun anymore. And I absolutely knew at that point that I would never drink again. I absolutely knew. It felt like some kind of a solution. Self-knowledge. But I hadn't been to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I couldn't have read your big book, so I couldn't have got to page 39 that said, for the real alcoholic, he will absolutely be unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. And that seems crazy to me. I think this folly of self-knowledge kills a lot of us because it feels like an answer. But I understand. I agree with you. I don't want to drink anymore. And we think somewhere in that intellectual surrender, there's some type of a solution. And there isn't. There's no power in that type of knowledge. But I don't know that. So I don't come to AA, get a sponsor, get a home group, start working steps, working with others. Why would I do that? I make the alcoholic declaration. I'm quitting drinking, so don't try to tempt me. And I'll tell you what, I quit drinking without AA. Thank you very much. For 2 weeks. In that short 2 week period, I think the muscle that is alcoholism, I think the tentacles that alcoholism produces started to stretch out and really start to grab the family. I didn't mean to do this, but I did one of the cruelest things I've ever done to my family because, you see, I told everybody I was quitting drinking and I actually did it. And the outside stuff that they can see starts looking good, right? Laundry starts getting done. I start showing up at work 5 days a week, which was new at that point in my story. I start showing up at family functions where I said I'll be there at 5 and I show up at 5. It's a miracle in my family's eyes. And they're having those backroom meetings. Did you hear the good news? Did you hear the good news? He quit drinking. No, he didn't go to jail or nothing. No, it was his idea. No, he's doing good. And it's the cruelest thing I've ever done to my family. I didn't mean to do it. Without knowing it, I gave my family the worst thing I've ever given them. I gave them false hope. Because you see, when I looked them in the eye and I said, I'm quitting drinking, they knew I wasn't lying because I wasn't. How could I have known there's no room for the truth where the game of alcoholism is played out? It doesn't matter how bad I don't want to drink. It doesn't matter that I don't want to live this way. It doesn't matter that I don't want to hurt you. I'm going to drink again, and I don't know that because I've lost the power of choice where drink is concerned. I'm now in a place of an obsessive mind where I don't have the human power to combat it. And it's got the perfect delivery system and all the time in the world. My voice in my head. And in that 2 weeks where it was my decision to stop drinking, I started to experience the worst aspects of alcoholism that really start when I'm sober, not when I'm drunk. The worst aspects of my alcoholism, I don't feel them as much when I got a half a load on drunk on the couch. It's when I'm sober. And Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, talks about, in short order, a guy like me becomes irritable, restless, and discontent, which I believe are the biggest understatements of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it doesn't feel that way. It sounds clinical, doesn't it? Irritable, restless, and discontent, you know? I mean, could you imagine I show up at a meeting, my good friend Steve there, and Steve goes, Donnie, how are you tonight? Well, Steve, now that you ask, I am a tad bit irritable, restless, and discontent. And what's Steve going to say to me? Oh, no, click your heels and say the third step prayer. You'll be fine, you know. It doesn't feel that way. I'm irritable. I want to hurt you. I'm restless. Maybe I'll go over there. No, I don't like them. Maybe I'll go over there. No, they don't like me. Maybe I'll get some ice cream. God, I'm getting fat. You know, just doesn't matter where I'm at, what I'm doing, who I'm doing it with. I'm in the wrong place with the wrong people doing the wrong thing. I can't find my place in the world. I live in a perpetual state of this isn't it either. A dog chasing his own tail, trying to find the right place to lay down, going nope, nope, nope. And I'm discontent, aren't I? Discontent sounds like happy or unhappy. Let me tell you, here's my definition of untreated alcoholism in a sober state. I have a complete and utter inability to experience joy regardless of the facts of my life. Man, I know what it's like to be 7, 8, 9 years sober, right? And all your dreams have come true. And you're doing that spiritual math in bed. You're laying there and you're going, well, I'm sober 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's going well. I'm well respected in my home group. I sponsor half of North America. That's okay. I got a good career going. I got no money problems. I'm married to this beautiful woman sleeping peacefully next to me. She says she's not going anywhere. Huh. If it was any better, I guess I'd go in the backyard and hang myself. And because I can't feel any of it. And you go to your sponsor and you're kind of panicked because your dreams have come true. And you go, man, on paper, my life looks great, but I'm anxious, I'm irritable, I'm restless, I'm discontent. He goes, it's untreated alcoholism, kid. It's a spiritual malady. And you go, that's not it. That's not it. Because I've fallen victim to the belief that length of sobriety equals serenity. Length of sobriety equals recovery. Length of sobriety equals spiritual fitness. I paid a great price. I didn't have to get drunk in those periods, but I found out. Irritable, restless, and discontent is available to me right now. 31 years sober right now. And it may show up to make a guest appearance when I wake up tomorrow. Because it shows up without permission. By the way, you don't have to do anything wrong. It seems to come with the territory of alcoholism. And sometimes you just wake up and your head goes, oh good, you're up, let's talk. Oh, you really got them fooled, don't you, Don? But we know you hate yourself, don't you, Don? Say it with us, I hate me. Say it, Don. You're like, oh my God, you run to the 11th step in the morning, you know? It's like, people think I do an 11th step routine in the morning because I'm spiritual. That's not why I do it. I do it because the hounds of hell stay up all night waiting for me and planning it. I mean, it's crazy. Well, it makes sense though, right? What do we talk about here? What do we need to survive? We need a conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves. Conscious, I'm awake. Contact, I'm connected. I need that. Guess what happens when I go sleepy bear? Unconscious. Book doesn't talk about an unconscious contact. Hey, if there's a higher power, there's a lower power, man. Right? It's the yin and yang of life. And maybe God can reach me when I'm conscious. And when I'm conscious, I got a feeling I know whose playground that is. Because I know how I wake up in the morning. And I don't wake up depressed. I wouldn't insult people who have actual depression. But I do wake up a little blue. Compared to how I'm going to feel after prayer and meditation. Which is why we do it. What's the first direction in the 11th step when we read that in the big book? The first direction. Before we do anything or say any cute prayers or read that spiritual stuff. It says we ask God to direct our thinking. Which, how did Bill know I'm going to wake up with bad thinking? Because he was an alcoholic just like me. And you get over that feeling like, I've been sober too long to feel this way. Really? Where's that in the book, the chapter, you should be here by now? It's just not there. I do everything you read about in chapter 3, various vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, brief periods of recovery followed always by a still worse relapse, a feeling I was regaining control to find out I'd lost more control. Pull the big geographic, move to Boston because L.A.'s my problem. Found out they drink in Boston. Wear out my welcome, takes me about 3 years to do that, and I come back to L.A. with my tail between my legs. But that's no big deal because I'm an alcoholic. And alcoholics are like a cat flung outside a second-story window. And we'll land on our feet, boom, in a three-piece suit in a job interview. You know what I mean? And I got the best job at the low point of my existence, man, coming back from Boston at that point. I mean, I got the best job I ever got in my life because we can get the job, get the girl, get the money. I can do that stuff. I just can't keep any of it, right? I'm a great getter, lousy keeper. And you know the rest of the story, man. I spiral down. And one day I hit the point where I'm just filled with terror. And I can't explain it. I've taken all my potential. 17 years old, graduating class athlete, 3.6 grade point average, 40 scholarship offers to go play basketball where I never filled out the first piece of paperwork because I'm full of fear. And now 12 years later, I'm 31 years old, dying from alcoholism, and I'm filled with terror. I'm living at my sister's house in Simi Valley, California. I got no car, no money. I burned my life to the ground. I got people calling me up, offering me jobs, and I'm lying to them. Oh, I wish he'd called a week ago. I just took another job, and I don't have another job. I'm afraid to leave the house other than to get booze. I'm living from unemployment check to unemployment check, and all the good is gone. And when I consider my options, what the conclusion I come to is there's no safe direction. And I roll up on my brother-in-law, and I do what I do. I borrow his car to go cash an unemployment check, and I steal his car. I thought I had bad time management. I got a sponsor in AA and said, no, when you borrow the car and you don't come back for 4 days, that's stealing. And I did not know that. And by this time, I'm living in a house because of my alcoholism that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism. My brother-in-law and sister are fighting, and they're fighting about me because he wants me gone, and she doesn't want to throw me out to the wolves, as she says it. And so now there's no love in their house, and there's no safety in their house. And I'm making those sweet apologies, you know. I didn't mean for it to get this wrong. I'm so sorry. And when I say I'm sorry, I mean it. But if you love me, and I hurt you one more time, and I promise to get sober, and I quit drinking to drink again, to quit drinking to drink again, to quit drinking to drink again, you're going to come to one of two conclusions, aren't you? One, I'm a liar. And as I said before, I'm not a liar. I meant it every time I said it. No room for the truth where alcoholism's played out. The other conclusion you might come to is, well, he's not trying very hard. Because if he had wanted to be sober, he'd be sober. Not trying very hard. Who tried harder than we did? I mean, don't you understand? I got a front row seat for the destruction of my life, that it's in the room with me every morning when I wake up, that thought, not tonight, God, please, not tonight, I'm dying. Yet I'm drunk most nights. I know everything there is to know about powerlessness. I begged my sister not to throw me out. I told her I go to AA and everything. I don't know why I said that. Seriously, I think it was an over-demonstration. I was not thinking about AA 2 days before I got here. And my sister did not believe I was going to go to AA. I mean, my first week in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sister took me to AA and picked me up from AA. You know, it makes you feel when you look the way I look and you get your older sister's compact car at the end of an evening of Alcoholics Anonymous and she's driving you back to her house, her 31-year-old loser brother. So, Donald, what'd you learn in AA tonight? And this is a bad look, you know, and I can't tell you about my first night in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can tell you about my second night because I hit the lottery. I didn't know there was a lottery in AA, but apparently there is because I look back and I go, that's the night my life changed. And I didn't know it. I didn't know it. If what had happened, if somebody had come to me right after it happened and said, you just had the most important moment of your life, I would have said, what happened? I missed it because I didn't see it. Because you can only see what you can see and you can only understand what you can understand. But here's what happened. I went to the Simi Valley Alano Club, and I went to the 6 o'clock meeting. It's an hour and a half long. It ends at 7:30. There's a half an hour break, and then there's the 8 o'clock meeting. And I'm hanging out between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting with a half an hour to kill, and I did not look that night the way I look tonight. I got hair down the middle of my back, and it's filthy because I don't shower anymore. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I'm wearing my sunglasses at night. I've lost the ability to speak the King's English because I've cooked my brain. I communicate in a series of hand gestures, grunts, and clicks. I got my back against the wall, and I got my arms folded, and I'm rocking my head back and forth looking at the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Simi Valley Alano Club. And I'm not taking your inventory, and I'm not trying to be a tough guy. I got my arms folded like this because every molecule in my body is screaming for a drink of alcohol. Because I'm coming up on 48 hours without a drink, and I'm physically addicted, and I'm about to explode from the inside out. And my head, which is where the problem of the alcoholic mainly resides, according to the big book, started talking to me. And my head said, look at them, Don, they're clean, they're happy, and they're not talking to you, and you know why? They don't want you here. Why do you do this to us, Don? Oh, you're going to quit drinking. What's this, the 100th time? You play this silly game, Don. Oh, I'm quitting drinking. Then what do? You take the pain. For what? 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. And then you drink anyway. Here's an idea, Don. Why don't we bypass the pain, get out of here and get drunk? You know you're going to drink. We know you're going to drink. Let's get out of here and go get drunk. And I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous on my second night to go get drunk. And it's going to cost me everything. And I want to be clear, I'm not leaving AA because it doesn't work, God doesn't exist, or the steps aren't a miracle. I'm leaving AA because I don't have the human power to combat a mental obsession beyond my strength. I've lost the power of choice where drink's concerned. We're always surprised when new people go and drink. I'm not. I always drink left to my own power. And I'm leaving to go get drunk. And it'll cost me everything, my last place of residence, the last relative that'll have anything to do with me. And more than likely, it'll eventually cost me my life, and that's a small price to pay if you can make the madness in my head stop for a couple of hours. And I've always been willing to pay that price. And I caught a break. Because over in the corner were two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark. And why it's the most important moment of my life, where my life is about to be decided in the next few minutes, for Lou and Mark, it was Tuesday. You know what I mean? And these good men were where they were every Tuesday night between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting in this clubhouse. They hung out together. And they drank that AA coffee. And they told those AA war stories. And most importantly, they had their eyes trained on the room and had their eyes trained on the door. And they were looking for men to 12-step. And then they took what I think is the most important action we'll ever be given the honor and privilege of taking in AA. These two good men walk 30 feet across the clubhouse to cordially welcome a man to Alcoholics Anonymous who was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And they did it in the kind, unassuming way we're taught to do it. Hi, I'm Lou. This is Mark. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us? I'm here to offer. That stuff saves lives. And why do I think it's so important? 30 feet for Lou and Mark. For me, it's a million miles. Don't you know where I've been, who I've hurt, what I've done? Don't you understand I can't get my eyes off of my shoes? You think I'm going to shake hands, work the room, ask for a phone number? If you think I'm doing any of those things, I hope you packed a lunch because you might have a long wait. No, these guys understood the terms of engagement for recovery from alcoholism. They would have to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And Mark sat down with me, and Lou continued to stand, and Lou clapped me right in the middle of the back and said, Don, this is Mark. He'll be your sponsor. And he walked away. And they assigned me my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that's not done everywhere, but it's not a bad idea if you think about it. We let the sickest person in the room pick the captain of the ship, and we do it all the time. And what do we say to newcomers? Find somebody that has what you want. What do I want my second night in recovery? Oh, I don't know, maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac, you know what I mean? Because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, because he's everything I'm not, you know what I mean? He's slight of frame, quiet of voice, wire-rimmed glasses, bald head. Elodie, ooh, he loves God, you know? Sometimes you hear people say, well, I don't hit the new person with that God talk till they get their feet underneath. He didn't get that memo. I mean, night one, he's talking about what God did for him, what God did for her, what God did for them, what God's going to do for me. He's on fire, and it's not what he said. It's not what he said. It's how he said it. Because he was armed with the most important thing you can be armed with when you talk to a new person, spiritual enthusiasm. He was a guy with a real answer. It was obvious he wasn't trying to sell anything. He was giving it away, and he only had a sincere desire to be helpful, and I could tell. And without my permission, he got a meeting directory, and he started circling the meetings I'd be going to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I knew that is he said, these are the meetings you'll be going to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought it was a lot of circling. He's asking me questions about myself. He's trying to get to know me. And God, you know, you feel so bad when you get here. You know, when somebody starts asking you facts of your life and you start having to say it out loud what a mess you've made of your life, you're so embarrassed at first. I didn't know that the worse you are, the more they like you in AA. Because as I told him things, he was like, oh, you live at your sister's house? Of course you do. Why wouldn't you? You don't have a car? Who needs a car? Oh, you haven't worked in a year? Good for you. I hate working, you know? You got warrants for your arrest in 2 counties? Well, you're an overachiever, kid. I started to feel better about my wreckage, you know? Then he asked me, he goes, are you working? And I said, no, I'm currently unemployed. More circling. Here's a weird thing, right? When I told him I was currently unemployed, you know what he said? It was bizarre. He goes, oh, that's great. A bizarre reaction to somebody else's unemployment. I mean, my God, if somebody that you met out in the street, you said, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm unemployed. You'd feel bad. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know. I'm sure you'll get a job soon. You want to get away from them. Not in AA. This guy knew. He said, oh, that's great. Because in his mind, he went, nothing between you and sobriety. No silly job and bills to pay. You can go to meetings all day. He was thrilled. He got me a big book, 12 and 12, handed me the meeting directory, and then he insulted me. Because if you're going to sponsor people, especially new people, get off on the right foot. Insult them as soon as possible. Because you're going to insult them anyway. When I'm new, I'm impossible not to insult. I'm so sensitive. You know, how you doing tonight, kid? Kind of a personal question, don't you think? You know, I'm sensitive. And he says to me, he goes, do you think you can go home tonight and not drink? That's just rude, isn't it? I mean, I'm coming up on 48 hours without a drink. And I snapped at him. I said, listen, buddy, any idiot can go a day without drinking. And he lit up like Christmas. He goes, oh, you're going to be perfect for our program. I mean, that should be one of our slogans, really. Any idiot can go a day without drinking, you know? Because we all know, right? It's not always spiritual enlightenment and spiritual development. Sometimes you just get through the day, you know what I mean? You hold on to your rear end and you cheer for midnight. Come on, midnight. You just get through the day. You live to fight another day. right? And so he got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went from drunk on the couch, basically, to 14 meetings a week with commitments, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember, I'm 45 days sober, and he, you know, I was taking commitments in AA, and I'm, and somebody, there was an open commitment to be a secretary at this meeting. And I said, is that something I'm interested in? He goes, no, you got to have 6 months to be a secretary. And I went, okay. And then I'm at another meeting like a week later, and I got 45 days at this point. And they had an open secretary position. And my sponsor goes, Don will do it. And I was confused. I go, I thought I needed 6 months. He goes, ah, we're going to make an exception for you. Which I thought meant I was special, but... And the third week, and it was a Sunday morning meeting at like 8 a.m. in the morning. Now I know why nobody wanted the secretariat, because you had to bring the meeting book and the treasury and set it up. And I did fine the first 2 weeks. The third week, I overslept. And I woke up, and it was like 7:30. And it's about a 40-minute walk, but I knew I could make it if I ran. And I ran all the way to the clubhouse of my sister's house. I mean, as fast as I could. And I had terror, and I knew what terror felt like. But now the terror was I didn't want to let those people in AA down. I didn't want to let my sponsor down. And I remember getting there, and I'm out of breath, and I'm sweating, and they're all looking at me like, Jesus, kid, you know. And I'm setting up the meeting, and I remember this little voice in my head said, look at you, Don. Look at you trying. I got introduced to the power of trying in Alcoholics Anonymous very early. You know, a lot of us think it's about achievement and accomplishment, and those things are wonderful. But that's not really what turns the tide in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're big on trying. Whatever you got that day, bring to the game. Bring to the game. Some days you'll have more than others, but whatever you got, bring to the game that day. And that'll be enough. And that's what I've done for 31 years. I've brought what I have that day to the game of alcoholism and to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I finished the steps. They kept their promise. And by the way, the promise of the steps seems very inadequate when you're new and you go, oh, I'll work the steps. What do I get? You know, a spiritual awakening. And? No, that's it. And how could I have known that the most valuable thing I've ever had in my life is a spiritual awakening? But I'll tell you what, here's the trick. Now that we've had a spiritual awakening, when you go through the steps, don't fall asleep. And man, have I fallen asleep many times in my recovery. But I've had all these wonderful experiences. And you know, you hit a year sober, you hit two. I had sobriety. You know, when I was 2 years sober, I'm still living at my sister's house. But things had gotten better. I cleaned up the warrants. I'm driving a death trap vehicle, admittedly. But I got one. I'm gainfully employed. It's a terrible job. I'm a laborer on a framing crew on a construction site. And I found out my true calling in life was to work with my hands. No, that wasn't true. I sucked at that job. I was horrible. I had a nickname at the job site, the bleeder. You know what I mean? So I go to AA at night and I go bleed during the day and I can't figure out why I'm so happy. I'm still hopelessly in debt. I owe the IRS $80,000, but I don't feel bad about that because in AA, no matter what you got, bring it. And we'll take it and we'll put it into service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor, he was great because he never pulled a punch with me, right? He was never Pollyannic about it. He never tapped me on the head and said, there, alcoholic. It's all going to work out now that you're with us. I mean, when he found out I owed the IRS 80 grand, he said, ooh, that's a lot of money, kid. He goes, and you're making minimum wage with taxes taken out. He goes, I don't know. You may never get out of debt. You may be broke the rest of your life. He goes, but you'll be sober, you know. When I complained to him about my life, about how hard my life was, he didn't argue. He goes, oh, I know, Don, I know. You have a terrible life. You do. And, Don, I make a gratitude list, and since I've met you, you're on my gratitude list. I always write, thank you, God, that you didn't make me Don. I write it every day. And then he'd laugh because he's trying to get me to laugh at my trouble. And he found out I owed that big debt to the IRS. He didn't tell me it'd be okay. He told me I'd be broke, but he put it into service in Alcoholics Anonymous immediately. For the next couple of years, till I got a kind of a jump on that thing, any newcomer that had the audacity to whine to my sponsor about his little $1,000 IRS debt, here'd be my sponsor. Hold that thought, Jimmy. Hey, Don, you got a minute? I'd walk over innocently and he'd say, Don, tell Jimmy how much you owe the IRS. And I'd look at Jimmy and go, I owe the IRS $80,000. And Jimmy would go, Jesus. And my sponsor would laugh and Jimmy would feel better. And I'd go, I just want to be a service. And I'd walk. And I learned to laugh at my problems in Alcoholics Anonymous because you taught me to do that. You taught me we all have problems, right? 3 years sober, man. I meet a beautiful woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fall in love. And I got to talk about sponsorship right now. I mean, because so much of my life is a result of good sponsorship, living transparently and letting somebody supersede on my behalf. When I met Eileen, you know, we've been married 27 years now, and I love her like good poetry, man. And when I met her, man, I fell head over heels in love. And I didn't like the way it made me feel. I'll be completely honest with you. And I called my sponsor up, you know, and I said, can I come over and talk to you about my relationship? Because they like that. They like to talk to you about your relationship. Oh, sure, kid, you go ahead and talk. I'll load my pistol. Yeah, then what did she say? Yeah. This is so interesting to me. And I go over there and I tell him I'm going to break up with Eileen. Been going out a couple of months at this point. He goes, oh, I thought it was going good. I go, it is. It's going fantastic. He goes, well, what's wrong with her? Why are you breaking up? I go, nothing's wrong with her. She's perfect. He goes, then why are you breaking up? I go, can't take it. Can't take the pressure. I go, I like it when they're into me, not when I'm into them. This is too much, right? And I can't risk her, this not working out. It's going to hurt too bad. I'm just going to put a pin in it because I just can't do this. And he called me a terrible name, and he told me I was not allowed to break up with my then-girlfriend. I said, I'm 34 years old. You can't tell me I can't break up with a girl. He goes, well, I just did. And he walked away real dismissively. Man, we used to have this argument where I would tell him, I go, I thought the program was suggested. And he'd always get mad. He goes, listen, Don. He goes, everything that comes out of my mouth is a direction. I'll let you know when you pass into the suggestion phase of the program, right? And I still haven't. I'm 31 years sober. I'm waiting for the suggestion phase of the program. I just get direction, you know? And I didn't break up with Eileen because my sponsor wouldn't let me. And I think about all the joy I would have missed in the last 27 years. And I'm telling you, it wasn't a... I was going to do it. Because that's where I was. That's what my head told me. This is too hard. I don't have to do it. I was afraid. And I had a sponsor that saw through my fear. What I do for a living today. I remember when I got that job, I got a chance to go into sales, and I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. I don't know anything about sales. My sponsor said, I don't care what you want to do. Go interview. Then they hired me, and I was pissed that they hired me. And then I sucked at the job. You know what I mean? Because they're giving me money against commissions I don't have. I'm there like 3 months. I owe them $5,000. I'm begging my sponsor to let me quit. Please let me quit. I suck at this job. What do they say? Well, they're happy with my efforts. They say nobody sells at first. He goes, well, you get to stop going when they stop inviting you back. And I hate it, man. And I'm trying. I'm reading sales books at night, but I'm reading a different sales book every night. So every day I'm a different salesman. So I'm psychotic. And I'm in the roofing industry, right? I'm the guy that comes out to your house, measures your roof, tries to sell your roof. And I meet this lady. And the night before I read this book and it had a chapter on instant identification. It said you have 30 seconds to identify with your client and build a rapport, or you've missed the opportunity. So I go up, I measure a roof, I come down, everything's going good, and I'm looking for the connection. And I can't find it. I'm looking, and then I see it. I go, there it is. And I go, perfect, instant identification. And out of my mouth, I go, how far along are you? And everything had been going great up to that moment, right? And she goes, what do you mean? And most normal people with half a brain would have put the shovel down, right? Stop digging. But I'm an alcoholic. I don't have an off button. I'm like, well, you're pregnant, aren't you? And she says, no. And the sober side of my brain's like, drop the shovel and run, but I can't stop digging. And I'm digging. I'm like, did you have a kid recently? And she says, 2 years ago. And I said, thank you for the opportunity to earn your business. And I walk back to my truck and I'm banging my head on the steering wheel. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And I got tears running down my face. I'm so embarrassed. And I call my sponsor and I, And I tell him what I've done, and now he's got tears rolling down his face because he can't stop laughing. He's laughing so hard he's hyperventilating. And he makes me promise, that I won't tell anybody else that story in that night in AA until he's there to watch their faces. And I've been in that industry for over 25 years. And it's provided a good living for me, and I'm really good at what I do. And I didn't know that you're not supposed to be good at something when you start it. That it takes time to learn to be proficient. I didn't know that, but a sponsor did. And I have 100 stories of a sponsor interceding on my behalf, telling me not to do something that I didn't see was dangerous, or telling me to do something that I didn't think I could do, over and over and over again. And I've been sober 31 years, so it's a complete picture. I've had every success you can have in life. I've had every joy, every accolade, but I've had every hardship. I've had every challenge. You know what I mean? Health problems, money problems, sex problems. Because it's the nature of life. It's the conveyor belt of life. It's built in a circle and brings us the same stuff over and over again. Good, bad, happy, sad. And in AA, you taught me, don't get transfixed on any one thing. If it's bad, don't stare at it. Don't obsess on it. Because right behind it could be something good, and you're going to miss it worrying about that thing that's bad. On the other side of it, if it's good, don't think it's going to last forever. Don't get cocky. Don't get stuck on it. You might miss the thing coming up behind it. It's the ebb and flow of life where we don't run the show. But we're all going to get our turn in the barrel for good and bad. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm running short on time. I want to tell you a couple of things and then sit down. 2022 was one of those years, man. It was like the beginning of the Charles Dickens book, A Tale of Two Cities. The first line in there is it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And that was 2022 for me. Because March of 2022, my wife and I, Eileen, we were in Maui for 10 days. And we're not go to Maui for 10 days kind of people. It was a big deal for us. And we had a great time. And we're old and wrinkled now. We always joke each other. Remember we were good looking and thin? And she's like, yeah, we were hot. We were, baby. You know, we look at pictures and go, damn, what happened? You know, and, what happened? Help me up, you know. And, you want to have sex or ice cream? Oh, ice cream. I'm like, 100%, baby, you know. If you get long-term sobriety, you get that good ice cream. Oh, she'd kill me right now. But man, for 10 days in Maui, we were teenagers again in our mind, you know what I mean? We're playing in the Pacific Ocean, man. We're eating mangoes on the beach and fish tacos at night, and it was just glorious. And I just remember us looking at each other going, isn't this great to be this in love? To have been through everything we've been through, the good, the bad, the indifferent, and we stayed the course, we learned to be married. You know, we've stayed active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and we thanked each other for being such good examples and for sharing this life together. And it was a wonderful experience. And then we came home, and the next month Eileen had to have a little checkup with the doctor, just a preventative thing she does at her age. And you know, I find myself a month later, you know, 3 weeks later, and I'm in an oncologist's office, you know, with my wife. And I'm hearing the stuff you never want to hear about the woman you love like good poetry. And he said, tumor, well-defined, stage 3 rectal cancer. And in that moment, whatever problems you woke up with that day become coated in Teflon and slide away from your life. And you're left with the only problem, the problem. And we walked through 8 weeks of radiation and 2 rounds of chemotherapy. And I watched my beautiful Eileen get very sick. And I watched her ravaged with pain. And as we went into that process, I was ashamed of how afraid I was. Because I've been married to her for a long time, 26 years at that point. I've always been her guy. And I know my job, but I'm afraid. What if I lose her? How would I move on from that? I can't imagine it. And she needs me now more than she's ever needed me. And I know I can't be there for her because I'm so full of fear. And I'm making it about me. And I called my sponsor when we got the diagnosis, and I said, I don't know what to do. I'm so afraid, and I'm so ashamed of how afraid I am. And he said, you need to pray about it. You need to meditate about it. And I prayed about it, and I meditated about it. And I'm meditating, and I'm meditating, and I'm meditating. And I'm asking God for an answer, and I keep getting the same answer. And the answer was, be grateful. That can't be right. And I meditate, and I meditate, and I get the answer, be grateful. And as I'm meditating, and as I'm getting this answer, be grateful, this film started in my mind, and it went back to the day I met Eileen. And it went forward, and things I thought I'd forgotten were attached to this film. And it was everything I had shared with her, the good, the bad, the ugly. The funny times when she shoved me in a pool in front of 100 people and laughed and ran away. The times we bought our first house and we were so scared and went, those idiots gave us a loan. Everything. 26 years of love, 26 years of fighting, 26 years of making up, 26 years of finding a way, 26 years of sharing life. And I saw this beautiful, beautiful thing. And at the end of it, I was no longer afraid. I was grateful. And I had a conversation with God. And I said, God, I don't know what your will for Eileen is. And I don't know what your will for me is. I never have. But I've been taught in AA, I don't pray for outcome. But you know what I want. But I'm not going to ask you for it because you've been so good to us. But you need to know this. We're so grateful. Thank you so much for what you've given me with Eileen. Thank you for every day that you've allowed me to spend with her. She's been the love of my life. It's the stuff of historic novels, and I got to live it. And I'm not saying I want it to be over. I'm just saying I understand. And I want you to know this, God, that you're not going to lose me. You'll never lose my love for you because I'm so grateful for what you've done for us. And we went on this journey. And my wife came through the other side of it, and we didn't have the end results yet, but they were done with the treatment. And the doctor came in, and he said, listen, we can't have the big scan for 90 days, but from what we've seen, we think it's been beat. We think you beat the cancer. I'm 95% sure, but you've done as well as anybody's ever done. We're so proud of you. You've done a great job. And he leaves there, and Eileen just bursts into tears. And she grabs me by my shirt really hard. She pulls me in, and she's crying. She goes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You've been so strong. You've been my rock. You've been there every step of the way. You've taken me to every appointment. You've taken care of the house. You've done everything. You've had an abundance of strength, and you've done it with a smile on your face. I don't have the words to explain to you how much I love you. And she's crying hysterically, and I didn't miss a beat. I said, oh, honey, that's just the drugs talking. You'll get over it. And she laughed like you laughed, and that's my job, is to make her feel safe and to make her laugh. And 90 days after that, we had the big scan, and she's cancer-free. 9 months after treatment was done, we scanned again, and she's cancer-free. But I need to tell you this, man. There's people in this room that have gone through what I've gone through, and they did not have the same outcome. And I'm not going to say for a second that God picked Eileen and didn't pick yours. I don't want nothing to do with a God like that. We were lucky. We were lucky that she was strong, and we're lucky we caught it in time. We were lucky. Because God doesn't play favorites. He loves us all equally. And I'm so grateful for that. In 2004, we moved to the Pacific Northwest from Los Angeles. I want to be clear that we're concrete, steel, and glass people. You know what I mean? And I find myself in the Pacific Northwest, 8 miles out of town, and it's dark at night, right? I mean, it's darkity dark, dark. I remember the first time I forgot something out in my car, and I walked out to my car at night, and I didn't have the porch light on. I didn't have a flashlight. And I got about halfway to the car, and a little voice in my head said, cougar. And I just jumped up and ran inside the house and slammed the door. And my wife's looking at me like, what's going on? What's wrong? And I go, don't go outside. It's darkity dark, dark out there. So there was an adjustment period. And man, we got deer in our yard every day. And the first summer we were there, man, the mama deer start showing up with their spotted fawns, and we lost our mind. I mean, if anybody needs 20,000 digital photographs of baby deer, see me after the meeting. We fell in love with this one mama deer and baby because she was just beautiful, and he had a big scar across his face, which I liked, you know, because I made up a story in my mind about how he defended his mom's honor and got stomped, you know. So we're city kids. We're naming a deer. That's Mama Deer and Scratch, Mama Deer and Scratch, right? Then winter comes, you know, or fall comes, and the deer start taking off their summer coats, and they're putting on their winter coats, you know, and but not Scratch. I mean, all the other deer, you can see the transition, but he starts looking bad. He starts losing all his fur and getting patchy, and I mentioned it to Eileen. I go, Scratch is looking rough, and she goes, yeah, and she's like that girl, man. So she gets on the internet and researches it and reports back to me that it's an affliction they get in their first year called deer hair loss syndrome. And if it gets bad enough, they'll lose all their fur. And then winter will come. They won't be able to eat enough to get their furnace going. They'll get hypothermic, and they'll die. And I said, Scratch is going to die? She said, yeah. I go, not on our watch. And we started breaking every law in the Washington State Wildlife Management books, man. I'm going to the feed store throwing 50-pound sacks of wet cob into my Toyota Avalon, you know. And the guy's like, how many heads you got? I'm like, I don't know how many head would this feed, you know, so I'm lying, checking my print. We're setting up supplemental feeding stations in the backyard, and when you're trying to feed the one sick deer, you can't feed the one sick deer. We got deer coming from everywhere. So we got 15, 20 deer in our backyard. I'm back there, they're 6-point bucks, 120 pounds, right? And Eileen's out there chasing 120 pound bucks out of our backyard going, you're selfish, you're self-centered, let the sick one eat. And she's chasing, he's done. Where am I? I'm on the deck going, be careful, he's huge. And we're feeding this little deer and it's not working, man. He's losing more and more fur. It got so bad. He lost all the fur in his body except a 2-inch wide, 2-inch high swatch of fur from his neck all the way down to his rump. And now we've overfed him, so he's rounded out like a beer cake. And he can barely move. He stands in my backyard. And he's just fat, ugly, mohawk, newcomer deer, just eating and pooping. And I'm obsessed with this deer. I'm obsessed. I call Eileen from work. I go, did you see Scratch today? She go, yeah. I go, how's he look? She go, not good. And I shake my fist at God. Not this one, God. You don't get this one. And, man, we make it through winter. We make it to spring, and Scratch doesn't die. And for the next 4 years into fall and rutting season, he come down from the high country with all the other boys. Now he's a magnificent buck. And we knew it was him because of the scar on his face. And just this huge rack. And he'd walk up to my wife real slowly. And she could feed him apples by hand. And I watched that scene and I think to myself, what is it about that damn deer that made me lose my mind? And one day it hit me. Oh, man, I'm that damn deer. I'm that guy sitting with my back against the wall in the Simi Valley Alano Club with anyone with a glancing familiarity with alcoholism would have looked at me and said, that guy, the guy over there, he's going to die. And two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous saw the same thing and said, not on our watch. And they did what we do, and they gave me spiritual first aid. They pulled me into the lifeboat. And I'm here to tell you, Bill and Bob are gone, and they're not coming back, but they've left us a beautiful legacy. And why we've been here this weekend, safe, sane, and sober, having some laughs, enjoying the fellowship, living the gift that is sobriety, they're out there on the streets within earshot of this meeting, and they are dying. And more importantly than that, there's something that we know that they don't even know yet. They're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they don't even know it yet. And they're going to show up like we did, hopeless, hapless, hapless, no plan. Looking for something that they can't put into words, but maybe it's here because they don't know where else to turn. And the question we have to ask ourselves, the good men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, when our new friends arrive in our respective home groups, where will we be? And more importantly, how will we be? Am I going to be sitting in my home group with the guys talking about fantasy football, my latest golf trip, my latest business deal? Because those things get discussed with my friends. Or do I leave that stuff in the parking lot and remember when I cross the threshold of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just another night for me, another string and an undeserved gift. But for somebody else, that could be the most important night of their life. And I don't want to miss it. So in closing, I just want to say, remember, they're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. They're coming looking for us. I hope we're ready, and I pray that we stay sober forever. Thanks for listening.